are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, May 10th, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks. On a Michael Thursday, this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Douglas Lane, author of Bash Bash Revolution, publisher at Zero Books, on the why, the truth, the delusion, the scam, the hustle of the intellectual dark web, and Marx's answer for confronting it. All that and much more with Douglas Lane. The Trump administration has pulled out of the Iran deal. The fallout continues as Iranian and Israeli forces apparently exchange rocket fire in Syria and in the Golan Heights. Prisoners released by North Korea as Trump brags about ratings. John McCain in one of his final bids for Maverick brand status is urging the Senate to reject Gina Haspel, the liar and almost certain personal torturer, as director of the CIA. I'm crushing it, is how Michael Cohen touted his access to companies. I got to be in a job where I could be in some type of... My goal is to be the first democratic socialist who's involved in a pay-for-play scheme where I can be involved and say, I'm crushing it. Novartis paid Trump's lawyers firm far more than any of its actual lobbyists. More crushing it by Michael Cohen. As the Europeans scramble to save and salvage the Iran deal, Ben Carson is targeting public housing with savage cuts, and Trump is preparing to meet with North Korean officials and the North Korean leader at a summit in Singapore, fresh off of the confirmation that the United States is stable and keeps its word on this sort of thing.
Mission accomplished.
Mick Mulvaney, he's got a lot of work to do at the Consumer Protection Bureau. Now, let's take aim at students. Get rid of consumer protections for them, obviously. And a new DHS proposal would change rules for minors in immigration detention. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. We are here in the new studio, the new setup. I don't even know, does this shot even look any different?
Yeah, just subtly, it's a bit different. I was watching it last night. It's interesting.
It's interesting.
The light's better, and you look. It looks a little bit more legit.
It looks more
by
legit.
By little, I mean a lot.
A lot more legit. I know it looked different on TMBS last night. Significantly different.
Yeah.
But we're still getting the lay of the land. We will get more lights.
It's an iterative process.
It's an iterative process. Calm down.
No more feedback.
Yeah. By which we mean we're not interested in your feedback.
Maybe later.
Potentially. But also maybe not later. One of the things about 2018 is that we live in a world where a guy that you wouldn't trust to be a regional manager of Applebee's is president of the United States. And that President of the United States, along, by the way, with all other Republicans, this is Republican foreign policy to detonate this deal and throw us into a new regional and potentially global crisis, to undermine something that was confirmed by all international observers as working to undermine moderate forces in the Islamic Republic of Iran to undermine something that in fact actually was containing Iran's sort of mobility of action from a strategic perspective, and also to undermine something that, of course, the only rational lesson to pull out of this, not to mention what happened to Colonel Gaddafi, not to mention the Bush administration destroying the North Korean nuclear deal back during the Bush era, would be to attempt to get weapons capability as quickly as possible. The other aspect of this is that you have somebody like Anthony Scaramucci, who, when he's not calling in this program and making some very woke comments, actually, he's on MSNBC. And I said this on some TMBS content. In some ways, he's doing a service because he's actually proving again that just because you test well and go to Harvard Law School doesn't mean that you can't be a absolute and complete and utter relentless moron, fool, idiot, yutz, and jackass.
Wharton.
Precisely. Here is Anthony Scaramucci. This is 2018. This is close to the end of human civilization. And he's talking with Stephanie Ruhle about the Iran deal. And now, again, of course this is distinctly stupid because it's Scaramucci. This is actually also mainstream Republican foreign policy that he's articulating on MSNBC.
Anthony, what does this mean for the United States and our allies? Ian Bremmer, who has given the president a lot of credit for what he's done in North Korea, has said this would be the biggest slap in the face to our Western allies, worse than pulling out a TPP, maybe, worse than the Paris Accord.
Maybe it's helping our Western allies. You know, I mean, it is. Well, let me finish. It's a very good time to be on the outside of the international community. When you're battling Adolf Hitler, there's a group of people in the international community that want appeasement with Adolf Hitler. If you go back to 1938, when they marked the appeasement, it wasn't peace in our time. We ended up with a devastating war that killed almost 100 million people. And so maybe the president is actually helping the allies by being the tough cop on the block that's going to impose something on Iran that is, you know, going to topple that regime.
No. That is not what's going to happen. And again, it bears repeating that, of course, in some ways, it is perfect that it's Trump and Scaramucci and all these people that really, they're as stupid as the arguments themselves that the neocons and the Republican foreign policy establishment make. Now, first of all, a mid-tier regional power who, in fact, has some synchronized interests with the United States with regards to specific types of Salafist terrorism is not the same as a European continent conquering monolith with a axis of actually genuine global aspirations of domination, right? So slightly different. And there's also no even Iran engaging in a proxy war in Syria is not analogous to invading Poland, Czechoslovakia, right? So besides the obvious things, then there's the reality that even if you wanted to do another delusional comparison, but a slightly more accurate one, the Soviet Union, yes, Reagan talked a lot of mess about the Soviet Union and they're an evil empire and so on and so forth. He also regularly negotiated arms control agreements with them. So there's no metric by which this is anything other than a dangerous joke. And I want you to hear Anthony Scaramucci saying that because I don't know who's going to say it. I think people in the sort of, you know, faux, never Trump, quote unquote, intelligentsia are hanging back on this one. But Bill Kristol and David Frum and all other members of the neocon hawk establishment who helped lie and push for the invasion of Iraq, who undermined the ability of transformed and detente relationship with Iran back in 2003. This is their perspective, stripped of pretentious historical comparisons and geostrategic verbiage and nonsense. That's what they have. Iran is like Hitler and stuff. So like this could be better. It's not going to be better. Might be better for a far-right Israeli government. It might be better for Gulf states fighting to maintain their hegemony, and it might be better for, you know, potentially, you know, certain parts of the arms sale market, and for appeasing Trump's ego, and also most importantly, opening up Sheldon Adelson's coffers. But this is an absolute catastrophe from a security perspective.
The Iran is Hitler thing reminds, it shows why they like to focus on ideas, because only the like sort of murderous ideology canard is the, it's the only like valid comparison you could possibly make. Cause if you actually talk about like history or like industrial power or war power, like, or where they are in like Europe, you know, like comparisons are just not there.
Well, right. That's why all of these idiots love the, well, what if Iran controlled the world? What would they do? Well, it's like, okay. I wasn't aware that we were playing like fantasy football, or maybe more to the point, Dungeons and Dragons. We're actually dealing with actual global issues here and actual institutions. And of course, all U.S. and, you know, the hype around things like, oh, Obama said there was a red line and he backed off of it. That was significantly exaggerated by the types of characters that go and pontificate on TV. But this type of thing, to pull out of a vital and successful and always internationally verified global arrangement like this, that took actual painstaking diplomacy in a way that has actually been rarely seen in modern politics from either administration, to do it purely out of ideology, impulse, and capriciousness, yeah, that fundamentally undermines all U.S. Credibility, to the point where, I mean, who looks responsible and rational in the world stage today, Rouhani or Trump? It's embarrassing even for a leftist like me how that's not even a question, that Iran looks more so. Brendan?
Speaking of Adelson, he just dropped $30 million into the coffers of Paul Ryan today.
Exactly. Exactly.
Three times as much as he did in 2016, folks. So this is all very real and moving in that direction.
I have no doubt that part of the subtext of this is getting people like Adelson excited to dump money into some tough midterms. But of course, there is something much more important happening in the world today than the undermining of the most successful diplomatic breakthrough of the modern era, arms control, soothing the Middle East, establishing a new relationship between the United States and Iran, cooling tensions everywhere from Yemen to allowing Gaza to not be an open-air prison anymore. And that is, of course, that there is a group of men on YouTube who have their books criticized. And Barry Weiss is on the case. The fact that Sam Harris, as an example, can't promote racism with and then gets called a racist for promoting racism. Really, really dangerous stuff happening that obviously on the real fundamental ideas level, really shows just how irrelevant all of these actually existing things are in context. So we're going to talk about free speech and the dark web with Douglas Lane when we are back in a minute on the Majority Report. And it's a protege, eh? Yeah. Chronics are where you say, eh? Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. Who knows? Who knows? Who knows? Who knows? I just go where the trade wind blows, sending love to my friends and foes. And I suppose sunshine, rivers, and trees. Please, wait. Hey. When me see Jah, me see a way. Drastically straight from hypocrisy, I say, hey. Every man to them own a philosophy. I live the proper way and then me read a chapter daily. Man, they in a city hungry and no eat. And food they down a country, does a drop off of the tree, then. You see, say poverty no real, then. Is what the reasoning revealing. To my friends and foes, and I suppose I'm pleased to be chilling in the West Indies.
provide all my wants and needs. I got the sunshine, rivers and trees, green leaves, yeah.
When the rain hits a pot on the roof, herb just a steam, pepper pot on the stew. Life is a dream if you got gratitude. So go tell the regime, them can't stop where we do now. Information you think on your own, or else you're a slave to the things that you know. What do you know if you learn every day? So be careful of things where you say.
Who knows? Who knows? Who knows? Who knows? I just go and got shaping blows, sending love to my friends and foes. And I suppose I'm pleased to be chilling in the West Indies. God provide all my wants and needs. I got the sunshine, rivers and trees, green leaves.
Welcome back. Michael Brooks on the Majority Report. That was Chronix and Protege. And joining us now is Douglas Lane. He's the author of Bash Bash Revolution. He's a publisher at Zero Books and host of the Zero Books podcast, which you can find both on iTunes and also a lot of very good video content on YouTube. Doug, thanks so much for being with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So, Doug, you are the perfect person to talk to about this, because just as I was saying in the intro, you know, I've been spending a lot of time on this show and my show talking about the fallout of the Iran deal, the implications for Syria, for Yemen, for a broader, you know, crisis in the Middle East, and the, even really the future of the foundations of arms control. But it's very easy to get lost in sort of trivial ideas and issues like that. In the face of the really, really important stuff, which is that there are a group of sort of mid-rank pundits who some college students don't like. So, you know, clearly there's obviously much bigger things going on. And that takes us to this, you know, sort of unintentionally comical piece that Barry Weiss came out with a couple of days ago called... it was something like Meet the Renegades of the Dark Web. And it's, you know, an introduction to a group, a cast of characters, Jordan Peterson, Dave Rubin, Sam Harris, and I think Michael Shermer and Joe Rogan. And basically a group of guys who are sort of constantly protesting that they're, you know, underexposed and underrepresented, even as they, you know, you just can't avoid them, from the New York Times to Bill Maher to endless YouTube and Twitter algorithms. I've never seen such ubiquitous silenced people in my life. You know, so, and that actually, you know, you put out a very insightful video recently on this sort of the kind of free speech hustle aspect of this, and these sort of people building brands on, you know, equating being criticized with being silenced, and then using a discourse of freedom of speech, which has nothing to do with what's actually taking place, thereby polluting the term in the process.
Right. I mean, I got a little bit of pushback for that particular video because there are a few people who I showed pictures of in video who I guess have actually been either fined or in some way or another sanctioned by the state for things they've said. And I just want to make it clear, like, I am against state censorship. Mm-hmm. And the left in general is against state censorship. But what happens is that they transform issues that are difficult into issues around free speech. In other words, when you wade in on a question that's difficult and fraught with emotion, you're going to get a reaction. And they turn that reaction into a reason to claim to be martyrs and a reason to claim to be suppressed. And they've done a good job. I mean, when he was still around, Milo did a really good job of getting the kind of reaction that looked foolish on YouTube,
right,
in order to kind of launch his career. They're smart enough to know about the Streisand effect or to use it when it happens.
What's the Streisand effect?
Well, Barbara Streisand sued a photographer for having taken photos of her house. He was actually a landscape photographer. I think he was doing a survey of the coast, and she had, her mansion was part of the one of the places that got photographed was included her property, and she found out about these photographs existing on a website, I think, and sued the photographer for invasion of privacy. And what happened was a website that had something like 3 views and, you know, was really not significant became very popular and got millions of views because of the lawsuit. So by trying to suppress this guy's photography, she ended up drawing attention to the photographs of her house that she was trying to obscure. And that's the Streisand effect.
Right. So what? Let's pick this apart. We'll sort of take it from micro to macro here. So yes, there is the element, and you know, you published Angela Nagel's book "Kill All Normies," very good book that kind of captured some of the dynamic of how these people were able to leverage a certain type of, you know, for lack of a better word, call out culture and leverage reactions that just looked bad from a brand perspective to sort of advance themselves and make their critics look foolish at times. That's kind of an old, I mean, it's an important conversation, but it's kind of an older conversation. It's also become its own cliche. So maybe like a couple, you know, it was important, I think, for those of us on the left to say, and I still do, just even just performatively, like, you know, you want to go embarrass Ben Shapiro, well, you know, do it right. You know, don't have a meltdown, and you know, that's what he's looking for. But I think that message has kind of registered. And so now we're actually much more clearly confronted with, you know, in most cases, and barring like state fines and so on, which I agree with you on, but in most cases, just this sort of bare cynicism of the move that these people make. And one of the examples of it in a specific way that we were just talking about in the office during prep was, as an example, someone like Sam Harris will say, you know, calling somebody as a racist is a thought stopper. It's a conversation ender because it's, you know, particularly in his case, he's someone who's actually, he's one of the ones on this side of the conversation that's very fixated and very, I don't know if it's just egoically and emotionally aggrieved or actually he's concerned about his brand's position, but he's very, very freaked out that he would get painted with a brush of bigotry, even as he dips into, you know, everything from, you know, retrograde foreign policy and sort of totalizing statements about Muslims to, you know, pushing, IQ and genetics, racial stuff, right? So, but yet being called out on that, you know, freaks him out, even though obviously he's entirely in traditions of bigotry on those grounds. But the point that we were making was that, you know, in a very different way, so like we were Bernie bros, and Bernie bros, actually, we got accused of sexism and racism and these sort of things in, you know, sloppy and dishonest and ridiculous and disingenuous ways all the time. And it wasn't a thought stopper, because in this case, or conversations, we were able to say, well, actually, no, that's inaccurate. And explain why. And what I wonder, you know, and that's where it starts to seem like the move is actually ironically just to block any exchange. Like Sam Harris, Jordan Peterson, these guys can go out and say whatever they want, but then we can say what we want. And then their response is either you're suppressing me by responding to what I said, or, you know, you haven't followed all of the little trinkets and caveats I've put in to try to get an out for myself. And ironically, it becomes a game of hide the ball.
Right. Well, I mean, I don't know. Sam Harris, you know, he at least tries to have debates occasionally. Although I would say that he is as much of a thought stopper as anything he complains about.
Right.
Because just for exactly the reasons you say, he gets hung up on basically issues of how he's being represented rather than what he's supposed to be talking about.
Right.
The big thing that is, though, that most of these guys who are worried about free speech or claiming to care about free speech aren't at all consistent themselves. I mean, for instance, Jordan Peterson wanted to create a watch list of university programs and professors that he thought were neo-Marxists and needed to be defunded. That's hardly the move of someone who cares a great deal about open and honest and intellectually rigorous debate. That's just a use of force, you know, to try to shut down ideas you don't like. The same thing is true of Tucker Carlson and his support for some legislation that was going to penalize students for political protest on college campuses. So these guys aren't consistent about their actual free speech position. And then the other thing is I think it's important to point out, and this is something that really bothers me, actually, is that they've all embraced, all these people on the intellectual dark web, these guys that are branding themselves together in the New York Times, they've all embraced red baiting as their primary point of common interest. So, like, Brett Weinstein, he's not the same as Ben Shapiro, right? Politically, they're not really aligned, except that they both are really concerned about the impact of what Brett Weinstein calls a critical theory, and Ben Shapiro would call it, I guess, Marxist or cultural Marxist, or I'm not sure, it depends, and maybe just hysterical social justice warriors. But the point is that they have their own story about what's the problem in our society, and it always comes down to their political opponents and villainizing their political opponents as part of a kind of a Jewish conspiracy, ultimately, although they, you know, couch it in different terms to hide the origin of the idea. So I find that really disturbing, that this sort of John Birch Society idea has become mainstream enough that a bunch of people who at least dip their toe in it are being, you know, hailed as renegade intellectuals in the New York Times.
And also the other kind of striking thing, just on a sort of basic elemental vigor level, like, you know, let's sort of take it across the board. I mean, the kind of, in some ways, like Harris is sort of the most easy and the most glaring, in the sense that, and actually Ezra Klein did a good job of pointing out how his own constant sense of persecution and aggrievement and his, you know, emotional identification with other overexposed white, you know, sort of idea peddlers who want to, you know, promote racist ideas, as an example, without being, you know, called as such, that is a form of identity politics. And why is it that he, as an example, could, you know, entertain a Charles Murray, but then say that, you know, a conversation with Ta-Nehisi Coates would just be hopeless and, you know, not fruitful. I mean, just the sort of inability to basically disaggregate there is obvious. But the broader thing that's fascinating is that how have they been able, they've generated a narrative that not only has its roots in anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, whether they know it or not, but also the fact that they, you know, we spend a lot of time inside the left disaggregating between, you know, well, you know, what is the driver? Is it cultural? Is it economic? Is it a fusion? You know, universal programs, and how do they intersect with dealing with you know, problems that persist in representation? What is our position on even things like Indeed, like the call out culture or whatever? So they're basically taking these viewpoints that are radically different. Whether it be a sort of, you know, basic kind of, you know, I don't know, for lack of a better word, SJW stance or a Marxist stance. And it seems to me that they're conflating it in ways that are both not totally non-distinguishing and non-rigorous to an embarrassing degree for people who self-profess to be intellectuals, which I'd like you to elaborate on. But also in a way where it seems that the commonality that it just sort of comes down to is that anybody, from the least to the most sophisticated, from the most polished and the most, you know, intellectually rigorous to the most, you know, emotional and reactive, but that basically anybody whose position in public life is that injustice is not a good thing and we should do better for humans that they are the problem, and we could just sort of pocket that all as Marxism or whatever.
Yeah, anyone who's dissatisfied with the status quo, I mean, that's not exactly fair that all of them think this way, but certainly Jordan Peterson,
yeah,
you know, is a fighter for the status quo, and anyone who is more concerned about fighting for social justice or changes in society than he or she is about their own personal success, say, is, you know, suspect and fallen prey to a horrible, villainous ideology of neo-Marxism, according to Peterson. And so there, obviously, you know, that's not even a position that you can consistently hold. And he himself doesn't consistently hold with the idea that you only focus on yourself rather than on social ills. I mean, he does ask his students to get involved with his own political projects, right? You know, but the main thing that I think that all of these people share is this desire for there to be a route to the truth that doesn't involve them. In other words, they want to be objective in a simple, straightforward way, which means that they have to take a lot of things that are part of the status quo for granted as if they could never be changed. I mean, that's the problem with sort of this white bread liberal scientism that out there is that, you know, it wants to claim this sort of objectivity and not see its own subjectivity. And that's, you know, I say it like that, it sounds very academic, but it's pretty simple. It's like, you know, for instance, if you're taking Charles Murray's word for what the science is on race and IQ, you ought to at least consider what your own political, social position is and be extremely rigorous and scrupulous about challenging what makes you feel comfortable, right? And that kind of observation, which maybe they'd nod along to if said that way, is something that they really, on a fundamental level, aren't capable of holding on to and trying to use.
Well, right. I mean, the perfect example of that is that, you know, Jordan Peterson is out running around essentially saying that until you have your life entirely psychologically and emotionally in order, you shouldn't interface with any political or economic institutional question or debate. Now, of course, it's a delusional standpoint fundamentally because, you know, systems work on and affect your emotional and psychological health. Like if, you know, your earnings, your job security, you know, all of these things have a major impact on the type of things he's talking about because no one exists in this sort of weird, you know, no man's land. But then on the other hand, yes, the amazing contradiction to say like, well, you know, a 19-year-old who thinks it's, you know, atrocious and disgusting that, you know, they're going into a, you know, vastly depreciated jobs market with lower earnings, or maybe doesn't feel good about their iPhone being made in brutal sweatshop conditions and mined from rare minerals in Africa that fuel civil wars and benefit the most powerful corporations in the world. That you can't say because maybe your room isn't tidy enough. But what 19-year-olds can be utilized to do is, you know, terrorize teachers that might tell them something about American history that makes them feel uncomfortable. They're certainly psychologically ready to do that. So, I mean, you know, the sort of obvious kind of comedy of those contradictions abounds. But, and we'll get to your collision with Peterson in a second. But what I'm really interested in is how is it that these people who are just, as you say, they're mostly status quo reinforcers, and they might in certain contexts be provocative in both good and bad, in the sense that, yes, there's a grain of truth that there is in certain very limited circles, maybe there's a quote-unquote PC culture, which is, you know, uptight about comedy or something, right? And maybe, and they can sort of zero in on that and hammer that all day and, you know, use the same handful of examples and grossly overinflate their importance, okay? And then on the other hand, they're also actually taking aim at really good and really positive hard-earned aspects of quote-unquote PC culture. Like, it is a good, hard-earned, and small social advances that, like, yes, in certain circles, you know, sexually harassing your secretary or whatever, you know, or even the fact that, like, people are stratified in those job roles along gender, that we've slowly, slightly progressed, that's a good thing. Or that we don't, yeah, you know, sort of openly promote racial hierarchies, and that's considered to be, like, not appropriate. These are actually, you know, barely the beginning of vital social advances that any decent society would hope to accomplish. So there's that. But, and then on the other hand, especially with regards to things like their relations to capitalism, to markets, to, you know, using sort of scientific anecdotes dumbed down and highly mediated for public consumption to justify income inequality and say that capitalism is somehow this natural organic state we're in versus a decided economy. This is all reinforcement of status quo. So how are they able to do this incredible, you know, and people point out the hilarious sort of paradox of people who constantly have exposure, constantly whining about their lack of exposure, but they're resonating with something. Like, that hustle, that ludicrous thing is working in their branding.
Yeah. Last night I was watching, because I'm, you know, middle aged now. I was looking at Mort Saul from 1992 interview Roger Ailes.
Oh wow!
And it was remarkable how similar they sounded to some of these dark web pundits today, with in their criticism of kind of liberal establishment types.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so why? But back then, I mean, Mort Saul sort of lost some of his lefty luster over time because he embraced aspects of the right, and no one was thinking that these two guys represented some hot new trend online, or of course, online barely existed,
right.
And no one was elevating them to be the new part of the new counterculture, right? So why is it that these same kind of attitudes and ideas are coming across as more controversial and more interesting than they really are now? I think it has to do, my theory is, and it's just a theory, I think it has to do with the fact that Occupy Wall Street didn't succeed.
Hmm.
That we had economic crisis and a political crisis after that, and the left's response to it was partial, and we ended up kind of retreating into a circular firing squad and a lot of scapegoating here and there and a call out culture of our own. And because of that, now we're at a point where just trying to return to normal sounds really hip and cool. You know,
yeah.
We've lived through this sort of failed attempt at change that was not brought on because people organized for it, but brought on by economic and crisis. You know, political crisis and then economic crisis. And I think the way to beat these guys is to think more deeply and organize something like Occupy that does the job better, that gets further.
That's really interesting because it's almost like a trope in our discourse about, like, you know, the 60s generation and, you know, the strides that were made, but also, you know, the backlash, Nixon and Reagan, and, you know, and the generation of 68 either, you know, failed and got marginalized, or they made their peace and, you know, in various different ways, either moved, you know, fully became, you know, reactionaries, or just sort of moved in a kind of neoliberal direction. Like, you look at, you know, Joschka Fischer as an example in Germany, going from, you know, literally street brawling and beating up cops to being the green foreign minister that, you know, implements, you know, EU integration and bombing Kosovo, and now is a global green consultant for, like, you know, BMW and other global brands. But that's interesting that maybe even for us, even like people don't register Occupy in the same way as like a moment that really was like, wow, maybe we can actually do this. And then it failed for a variety of reasons. And that's still actually hitting us.
Yeah. I mean, we had the Arab Spring and Occupy together, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Occupy was inspired by the Arab Spring and after 2008 which was the economic crisis, was still fresh in everyone's minds. We thought the global capitalism itself was going to fall out from under our feet, or some of us did. And a lot of, you know, kids then really were looking at very bleak futures, and they didn't blame, you know, blue-haired gender studies majors for it. They blamed the banks.
Right.
And but then we weren't organized. There's some real serious difficulties in overcoming the system that we're in that no one was prepared to fully address, or, you know, and including me, including anybody on the left. And so, I think part of this is just a consequence of the way we haven't been able to quite accomplish a transformation. But, you know, that's sort of a major revolutionary's, you know, answer. Well, the problem is we haven't had that revolution yet. And that's always the problem. I do think it comes out of 2011. I really do. I do think that we kind of moved into a identity politics and call out culture on the left, and then on the right there was a great move to make hay out of that, and that we saw the way that we were co-opted, that movement was co-opted, you know, come around and bite us and empower the right.
What is you have a specific experience, and I believe you're actually on your way to potentially try to have this conversation that's been blown off, but you've had very revealing interaction with the histrionic fascist shaman, Kermit the Frog voiced Jordan Peterson. What is that?
Well, okay. I have to say it's been entirely one-sided. In other words, I emailed him and then his team, his publicist, to try to get him onto the Zero Books podcast.
Right.
When I did that, I actually got a lot of heat from people on the left saying, why are you bothering talking to this guy? Now I don't think anyone would say it that way.
Right.
Anyway, his team canceled on me at the beginning of this year.
Initially they said they would do it, and Jordan Peterson has done a lot of, like, you know, he sits in the Rogan studio and does a lot of like, well, I'm ready if they could defend their ideas. And you came along and you said, hey, I'm a dirty, you know, communist who wants to end capitalism and thinks that racism exists. And, you know, I'm ready to take you on, buddy. And so there you go.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And so, yeah, he was willing to, his team thought it would be fine to go on my show. You know, I mentioned Kill All Normies, which they might have heard of. And so they were going to have him on. And then, to promote his book, but then it turned out, you know, he didn't really need to come on my podcast or such small fry podcast. And I don't know if they caught wind of who I was and got cold feet or what exactly happened, but they canceled the promise to reschedule. Then Peterson went on Joe Rogan, and Rogan asked him, hey, do any of these Marxists that you hate so much ever debate you? Have you ever actually talked to any of these guys? And his answer was no, they don't want to debate me. They don't ever ask me to. They don't want to talk to me. Right. They're basically, the implication was that they're afraid to really expose their ideas to the light of day.
Right.
But in fact, at that very moment, I was trying to get him to come in on my podcast to talk to me. So it was a violation of what is listed as Rule 8 in his book, The 12 Rules for Life, which is never lie.
Basically you found, I mean, maybe not necessarily a mess, but some scattered papers in his room.
Oh, I sure did. Yes. And I would say I've been told I should keep this under wraps just in case.
Yeah, no worries. Yeah.
I'm going to see him. He's in Seattle today on his tour. And I plan on trying to ask him about this
trying to have a free and open exchange of ideas, which I normally oppose, but in this case, I support. Well, I want to talk. I want to get to Bash Bash Revolution a bit, which is such an amazing book because it actually got me to read a sci-fi book, which is a mind-blowing accomplishment. But do you have what is the part? I was actually talking with a friend of mine about this the other day, and he's more like he's in more in that kind of tech world, and and there's a lot of resonance in this stuff. And I think that this is almost like the, it's better to think of this stuff as, this isn't a real intellectual movement. It's a lifestyle brand, for a particular type of, I think a particular kind of brand identity. And obviously like in Jordan Peterson's case, self-help. But there's a part that just feels so like, I did the opening segment on the show on this, the massive fallout of this, it can't be underscored enough, the just utter disaster of the Iran pullout. Of course, all of the usual biggies that at this point we just sort of note in a numbed way, but really are, the systemic crisis of climate, of global warming, Ben Carson wants to take an axe to public, housing in a way that will, obviously viciously harm so many people. Net neutrality, ironically, in the context of all of this internet-enabled stuff, that's, Ed Markey has a bill in the Senate right now to try to protect it from the, Republican FCC's decision. So everything from, macro to micro, we just have so many actual real things to deal with other than these sort of like peddlers of mediocre ideas and empowerment of sort of reactionary politics. There's a part, and I'm going to get a little Alex Jones here, but it just feels like this is all, it's all coded. They're flooding the zone with nonsense so that like instead of having a half an hour conversation where Doug Lyon and I actually talk about real things and need to be addressed, we're talking about these morons, but they're getting New York Times profiles and they're taking an unbelievable amount of oxygen with ideas that it's like, and I think there's another thing that these, that their followers and the kind of cults don't understand. The ideas have been addressed. The bell curve has been critiqued. Horrible foreign policy ideas have been critiqued. Scientism and positivism have been critiqued for centuries. And even the other stuff, it's like, yeah, great. Clean your room. Eat a high protein breakfast. Take a run. I'm a big fan. Believe it or not, my apartment is very tidy. Great.
I believe it.
Yeah. So
not so much my house, but I believe it.
Bucko. But so where where's the part? I don't know. I don't even know how to phrase this as a question, but it just seems so like this is like almost in a. It's a very sad and not fun. There's no like it's it's not. It's not a party. It's not like great pop culture, but this is, it's basically just like a bread and circus show that's distracting us from real shit we got to get on top of, but at the same time also opening a door to even more damaging things. I don't know. It's very frustrating. I don't know if that makes sense.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, no, it does. Okay. So I want to say one thing, and I'm just using this as a way to plug, but while it's true that the New York Times ran a piece on the intellectual dark web and gave them a boost. They also ran a few days earlier a birthday greeting to Karl Marx that one of our authors of several books wrote, the author of Marx Returns, Jason Barker. And it made Jordan Peterson and Ben Shapiro and Glenn Beck and James Wood tweet like crazy at the New York Times about how dare they try to bring this outmoded, backwards, mass murdering ideologist to the New York Times.
Right.
I don't know. I think the idea that the capitalist media will just put anything out there if it might get some clicks is maybe true. The other thing is
The Economist just ran a piece on how like it was something to the effect, and of course they did their usual bob and weave, but the broad point was that Marx is surprisingly relevant to understanding today's capitalism. So even in The Economist.
Right. No. Yep. Yeah. And no, I think that people should really read, like, forget about Bash Revolution. I don't, but it really read Capital Volume One. But the point that you're making is there a conspiracy of, I mean, you're not really asking.
Not consciously, but yeah. Just that dynamic when it's like, it couldn't be more urgent to deal with real things than ever. And yet, like, this just sort of peak middle brow bullshit is so front and center to the agenda that actually, if we did ignore it, it would be like the same way that I basically tried to ignore, like, Gamergate several years ago. Like, whatever, I don't want to talk about this shit. There's things going on in Yemen. And now, you know, yeah, and now those guys, like, run the Republican Party.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
I think what it is that when you are up against a really difficult problem, people who sound confident and say things that you already think are going to be appealing, and they get to say the big plus for them is they get to say things that some people already think but are afraid to say, like,
right,
you know, maybe black people have low IQs or something like that.
Right.
And so that's why they're appealing in a way. But I really think what it is answers, even wrong answers, are better than just questions that leave you anxious that you don't have an answer to.
Right.
That's how people are kind of constitutionally. They want closure all the time. And these people offer a kind of closure and a way to identify. I mean,
yep.
You know, that's like, it's fun to think that you're as cool as Ben Shapiro, I guess.
I guess. That's a whole other very disturbing thing to me. Like, when did that become cool? Jesus.
I know. Well, maybe we're overestimating this. You know?
Right.
The New York Times is not really setting the agenda for the youth of today.
That is totally true. But, I mean, some of these guys are definitely, you know, if it wasn't reflected back in a lot of online interactions and even just sort of questions that I got, I wouldn't take it nearly as seriously. And so, like, you know, I know as an example, I know that Alex Jones, I mean, it's important to keep an eye on him and it's incredibly entertaining. And actually, unlike all these other people, he's actually a genuine broadcast talent. I mean, Alex Jones leaves, you know, Dave Rubin. I mean, the only one of the guys in the whole article who has any sort of, like, just basic talent is Rogan. You know, everybody else, oh my God. But, you know, I know that Alex Jones, like, I know that there's nobody who's watching me and then also going to say, like, hey, Michael, I'm a fan of both yours and Alex. And I know you don't see eye to eye, but I'd really like your thoughts on brain, you know, on, you know, Brain Force or whatever. Right. But
on gay frogs.
Yeah. On gay frogs or, you know, or, exactly. Or like the conspiracy, you know, Obama wants kids to sleep with, you know, to have sex with cars or something. Right. Like, that's not going to happen. But these guys, you know, they pop up. And frankly, I honestly find it, you know, I don't think any of it's particularly more intellectually enriching or rigorous or relevant than particularly anything that's coming out of Alex Jones's mouth, to be honest. I mean, I get it's not as absurd, but it's certainly not. But at any rate, how does this interface with Bash Revolution, your new novel?
Well, okay, so I guess the only thing that I would say that interfaces with this is that my novel, along with other things, is a critique of what I'll call instrumental reason.
Yeah.
The main character's dad is one of these kind of techno-utopian scientistic thinkers who kind of conceives of life as being a race between human intelligence and human stupidity. Mm-hmm. And who just fails to notice how the human stupidity and intelligence are always intertwined.
Right.
So his goal, I mean, Trump is elected in the book and there's a threat of a nuclear confrontation, nuclear war. And his goal is to get the AI to help him save humanity, basically. And his way of doing it is to perfect everyone to through scientific means and AI enhancement, make everyone the best version of themselves that they can be. But what he discovers is that only escalates the conflict, that only escalates the crisis. When people are smarter and faster and, you know, more intelligent and healthier, they just do the same things more efficiently. And so something has to change on a different level, not on the level of perfecting biology or retooling what is, but to create something new. And that's a kind of a major point and theme in the book, is that the AI enhancement just isn't really working. And every time he gets better at juggling, we don't get any closer to escaping our doom, right, or to utopia.
Right.
The same thing.
And of course, I mean, that's obviously, that's definitely the sort of Sam Harris scientism angle. Peterson has a scientism, but he's also trying to reinforce a kind of very reactionary mysticism. That actually leads me to the last question. We've talked about this. One of the things that's so bizarre specifically about Peterson is that he has Shapiro is basically just a far right, typical far right conservative who thinks Trump's a little uncouth and, is totally racist towards Arabs and has the same just kind of, deregulate social reactionary policies, blah, blah, blah. And then, Dave Rubin's just kind of an airhead who nods along. And Sam Harris is a scientist, is of scientism, and it's sort of bad foreign policy with positivism and a trust fund and zero self-introspection. Peterson is very weird because it's a fusion of, he's very, very socially reactionary, but he's also trying to make a case for naturalizing capitalism, which in both, capitalism in both very good ways from a perspective of social progress and also in very negative ways is never going to allow in the long term for the types of, social stratification and, traditional gender norms that he pines for. So he really has a contradictory viewpoint, and, that maybe that's for the next novel.
Yeah, no, I definitely think that Peterson, the way he's self-contradictory is interesting. And that's actually probably one of the reasons he's so appealing, is because he does offer people some things to think about that aren't just, clearly talking points for some part of the Republican Party.
Right.
He Joseph Campbell was a very big pop phenomena and was of interest to lots of people. And his lectures are still probably being watched by a certain subculture today. And all of that power of myth and what is human nature and what is the human imagination made of? Are there categories that are universal to the human imagination? Can we see them across cultures? All of that is interesting. I am not aligned with Jung at all, and I think Joseph Campbell's work but I still think it's interesting, right?
Right.
So that is one of the things that Peterson has going for him. The problem is that he wants to ground our identity and our ancestry, evolutionary ancestry, but also I think cultural, and that could very well bleed into in our racial ancestry as well. I mean, there's aspects of Jungian thought that can align with really reactionary fascist racialist thinking.
Yes.
And so that's the fact that he's interesting is actually one of the things that makes him sort of more dangerous.
I will slap you happily.
He likes, he's a monster.
Yes. Right?
That's what is one of his big talking points, is be a monster, but hold it in check.
Jesus Christ. it's so nice that all of these incredibly emotionally healthy people are exerting such a big influence on culture. Maybe it's like Sam Harris needs therapy, Jordan Peterson needed to do less therapy, and I don't know, Ben Shapiro needed to lose his virginity at an appropriate age. I don't know. And Dave Rubin was just hopeless. I don't know. Hopefully
let's not go there. Let's not go into the virginity thing. Oh my God.
Okay. Fair enough. Well, I'm talking very specific. Something needed to happen for Ben Shapiro. I don't know what. I mean, but my God, not even a hand job on Birthright? Okay. Douglas Lane, he's the author of Bash Bash Revolution. He is the publisher of Zero Books and host of the Zero Books podcast. Very, very good podcast and YouTube content and everything else. Douglas, appreciate your time as always.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much. All right, folks, become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate, get the Majority Report blend. Last night, we had a Wednesday episode of The Michael Brooks Show. We did a deep dive with Glenn Greenwald on the coup in Brazil, the assassination of Marielle Franco, and also touched on global torture regime, Gina Haspel, the Iran deal, and Julia Salazar, DSA, state Senate candidate. And there's a lot of now additional Patreon content for that show. Big Waz, Waz and I are doing a show that is exclusively for TMBS and Count the Dings patrons now. So join today if you haven't already, patreon.com/TMBS, or find it on iTunes or YouTube on the Majority Report YouTube channel. We're in the process of setting up our own YouTube channel. Antifada, I believe a new Antifada is dropping today. And of course, also Jamie Peck Patreon, where you can read all of Jamie's writings. And you can also find Antifada on iTunes and Patreon. This Saturday, I'm moderating a panel with Jamie and some other people, DSA, Community Healthcare Day. We'll throw a link to it up on our blog. If you're in the New York area, it's going to be in Greenpoint in Brooklyn. Come say hi. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. IMs are open. See you in the fun half.